Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am your host, Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor of history at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Yusun Park, an associate professor of social policy and practice at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to be discussing her latest book, Facilitating Injustice, the Complicity of Social Workers in the Forced Removal and Incarceration of Japanese Americans, 1941 to 1946, which came out with Oxford University Press last year in 2020. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Yusun.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Why don't we begin, as we traditionally do on the New Books Network, by just hearing a little bit about yourself. What is your background? How did you become interested in social work? And in particular, how did you become interested in the history of social work?
Well, I actually started studying, I went to graduate school for the first time and studied Buddhism, comparative studies in Buddhist philosophy. And got really bored of it because I went into it thinking that it was going to be about really how do you live, right? And academic Buddhism, it turns out, really Buddhist studies is really about, you know, which monk met what other monk in what century and things like that. So I eventually turned to social work as a more applied discipline, I guess. And I had been interested in it for a variety of reasons, and part of which is that I'd done volunteer work teaching English and tutoring to Southeast Asian refugees. So that's how I got into social work. And then insofar as why the history of social work, I think when I was getting my master's at University of Washington, the education just brought up a lot of questions for me. Why is social work the way it is? Why do we teach the things that we were teaching? Why are interventions that social workers use the way they are? So the obvious answer was to really go back into history and try to figure out how we got to where we got. And as I'm a Korean immigrant, I came to the US when I was 11. So immigration was also an obvious place to go. In my experience, as an immigrant in my life, the immigrant mythology of the U.S. as a having open borders and having always, you know, being a country of immigrants, always welcoming, didn't really gel. So I wanted to study it to see what actually happened. And, you know, in my high school, in my undergrad, I was never offered any information about immigration history, and nor was there any in my master's program in social work. So when I got to the PhD program, I decided to really do it myself and start studying it. So that's how I got interested in this work.
As a historian myself, but not a historian of social work or social policy really much at all, and we can talk more about this, but I thought that this book was fascinating because it was a topic that historians, at least to my understanding, have not covered very much, the history of social work. So, you know, just from my perspective, it felt to me like you were really filling a gap in the historiography with this work.
Yeah. I mean, there are really some classic texts of history of social welfare. And actually, you know, people like Linda Gordon have done really amazing work that talk about parts of social work. But I also think that it's really important that social workers, as a social worker, that more history is written by social workers, yeah. And not from an outside perspective. I think, unfortunately, social work as a discipline has gone increasingly more towards really the medical model and the more liberal arts impulses that are required to really spend more energies on things like history have eroded, which I think is a problem, a deep problem in social work. So there aren't that many social work historians, I have to say, which is a sad truth about us.
How did you decide, or how did you, what was the genesis of, let me put it that way, the genesis of this particular book? Why write a book about, as you know, the title indicates, the complicity of social workers in this particular moment in American history, in the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II?
Yeah, so I ended up doing a historical dissertation. I was really pushed into it, and I'm very grateful about it by one of my professors, Susan Kemp, Dr. Susan Kemp. And I was doing a historical discourse analysis of the representation of immigrants in social work. So I ended up reading just about everything that three major publications had written about that were in written by social workers in these three major publications, starting at 1875 and really ending somewhere in the 1950s, and came across just a few articles, maybe like four or five articles that mentioned that social workers had been involved in this phenomenon, in the removal and incarceration. And I was really shocked because I'd never seen this before. So I then went to every single social welfare history book I could find to see, you know, went through the indexes to see if anything had been mentioned. So, and I found that no, absolutely nothing had been written about this in any book whatsoever. And I then went to my professors and asked them about it, and nobody knew anything about this except for one person who was my dissertation chair, Professor Tony Ishisaka, who had been born in a concentration camp at Amachi. And so he knew about the history, but nobody else did. So I got very curious about how is it that this monumental thing that we did in this really monumental history had been completely occluded, and that no social workers actually knew about it, and nothing had been written about it since the 1940s by social workers. And then I went to, there is a vast literature on the phenomenon itself. So from historians and anthropologists, and there's lots of memoirs and life histories and so on that is about the removal and incarceration process. And so I went to every single one of them really and found that nobody really remembered that social workers were so heavily involved in it. So I wanted to really know how something like this gets forgotten. And I wanted to know what it was that drove social work, which really prides itself on being a social justice oriented profession and a discipline. How did social work get involved in this and what did they do? So that's how I got into it. So, I mean, I think it's really important to really note that I wasn't writing a history of Japanese American experience. That's been done, and I'm not Japanese American, so that's not my story to tell. What was a story that I wanted to tell was the social work involvement from a social work perspective.
For those who might not know all that much about the field of social work, can you talk just a little bit about how social workers see themselves and what they do, and maybe a very brief history of the field of social work leading up to the Second World War? And I know that that's a big question to ask in not a lot of time, but I'm wondering if you can maybe just give that kind of brief overview for us.
I can try. I mean, I think most people sort of, if you ask that question, they'll go back to English poor laws, but I won't go there. What I will say is that I think it, you know, social work, Thinkers themselves would say that it was established in the 19th century, and that it was really to deal with, to ameliorate, is a word that social work historians like to use, the problems that were arising from an increasingly industrializing nation. Most of early social work was done and was formulated, in my view, in working with white European immigrants. And so working in the urban setting, especially in the poor neighborhoods, the slums, where the recent immigrants tended to go. So the social work profession and social work ideas and social work philosophies and the kinds of theories and interventions that came out and are really still being used were built, really constructed with this population in urban settings, especially on the East Coast, if you look at the time period, because it was really concentrated in the East and not on the West Coast at all. And it grew out of Protestant, Christian, wealthy philanthropists and people who were involved in charity work. And so charities and private philanthropy that eventually grew into much more scientific charity work and became professionalized over time. And in, you know, before this history that I was writing about, through the 20s and 30s, increasingly professionalized and eventually going into government work, super involved in the New Deal and the development of social insurance, social security, and so on. So by the time we're into World War II, we are, social work has sort of jumped in and is really deeply involved in, federal government work. And I think it was one of the things that really shaped how social workers responded to these events during World War II, because the Roosevelt administration was a big supporter of the social work profession, and social work as a profession was very involved and supportive of that administration. So I hope that answers that somewhat.
It does. Yes. You begin the book by talking a fair amount about your own methodology and how you went about doing the research for this book. And if I may say so, this is a very, very heavily and well-researched book. And I'm curious if you could talk a bit about the sources that you used. You already mentioned how there isn't a particularly large literature around this specific topic, but what does exist? And are there a lot of primary sources that you could use in researching this book?
Yeah. So like I said, there's a huge body of scholarship about the general phenomenon, but not anything about social work involvement. I really think I can claim that this is the my work, this book and my earlier papers on the topic are the first to examine this phenomenon since anyone wrote about it in the 40s as it was happening, which meant that it was actually kind of a scary proposition because as a historian, you will know this, but there was nowhere I could go to really check to see, okay, like, am I completely making this up as an interpretation or did this really happen? Or, you know, did this happen in the way that I thought it did? So it took me a really long time because I would have to go to so many sort of peripheral sources to check out ideas. And there is quite a lot of primary sources. And one of my major sources was a cache of materials that really massive amount of stuff that was kept at the California State Archives in Sacramento. And that was the work of, that documented the work of the California State Department of Social Welfare, which administered the removal process and then the resettlement process for the bulk of the population that were incarcerated. So a lot of reports and budgets and a lot of handwritten notes and accounts by social workers who were working. And then the National Archives in DC had quite a lot. The Social Welfare History Archives in Minnesota University of Minnesota has quite a lot of information that you could find that not many people had looked at. And I was at Smith College at the time, and Smith College has the archives of the YWCA of the USA organization, and they were heavily involved as well. So they ended up being a really, really useful source. And Washington State Archives, Oregon State Archives, but there were a ton of regional archives for both the National Archives and other things that I did not look at, simply because flying around and going to archives is expensive business, and I could have gone on forever looking at the materials. One of the real boon was that the Bancroft Library at Berkeley, in UC Berkeley, had digitized some of these records, because when the War Relocation Authority dissolved, and War Relocation Authority was the civilian agency that was built to manage and build the relocation camps. When they dissolved, the records that they kept went to NARA, and then also in part to Berkeley. And Bancroft has managed to digitize a lot of it. So that was very useful as well. And aside from that, the official records and lots of publication that the War Relocation Authority, WRA, put out had probably the most information on how the camps were run. So I could find bits and pieces about the social welfare departments that existed there, but they were very uneven. So the social welfare departments did keep records, and they wrote reports and so on, but they varied a lot camp by camp, and from whoever was running it, put different kinds. So the camps were really put up hastily. And so there was not a whole lot of planning put into it. So the records actually reflected that. So.
Well, let's get into the history here that you tell a little bit. And let's start by just setting the context a bit. What was the context for removal and for incarceration? How did the United States government justify this process? And how were social workers implicated in this justification process really from the very start?
So Japanese Americans were rounded up and locked up as soon as Pearl Harbor happened. So initially, the FBI ran around and arrested people who were leaders in the community. Anybody who was a civic leader, anybody who was a newspaper editor, let's say, an interpreter, so on, as likely to be an enemy alien who was going to be dangerous. And they got locked up in different sets of camps. But almost immediately then, I discovered records in the California State Department of Welfare that said that they immediately formed an advisory committee to really look at, okay, what's going to happen? So the response was almost immediate. And then all kinds of organizations the YWCA, for instance, which was about the only organization, and its offshoot, there's one other organization called the International Institute, which was an offshoot of the YWCA, started really thinking about what's going to happen, because they were the only two organizations that worked with Japanese Americans at the time. And then there was a period of it was called the voluntary evacuation period, where Japanese Americans were told to move out of the coastal areas. And the Social Security Board was given some money to provide assistance for people who were going to voluntarily evacuate. So that assistance was run through the welfare department in California and other states. So almost immediately involved. And in how they were done was that social workers who were working in county social welfare departments and state social welfare departments were lent out to the Social Security Board to provide assistance and so on. But in that initial stage, not much assistance was asked for by Japanese Americans, in part because few could voluntarily evacuate as the misnomer, because they were really tied to the lands. And as so many of them were farmers, and so very little money was spent, and Japanese Americans had very little experience with welfare and any sort of government aid. So even if they needed it, nobody was asking for any of it. And then the other part in the early periods that I can think of is that Japanese assets were frozen immediately. So banks weren't operating. And so mutual aid societies, Japanese American social service agencies and groups couldn't process any of their funds. So they did go to social welfare organizations in places like San Francisco to ask them, can we process money through you so that we can actually help our people, kind of thing. So almost immediately involved. And then congressional testimonies, social workers spoke at. So that was the beginning of it.
And then continue.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to ask about the next step in the process, because not long after, the involuntary removal process begins, in which, as you describe in the book, social workers were heavily involved in that process as well.
Yeah, once the removal process began, and that's what I think most people know about. So the signs going up everywhere saying you have 1 week to actually report to be removed with the... And so social work, every single person who was incarcerated was interviewed by a social worker. So these sort of pop-up places were set up where Japanese Americans were asked to report to, and they would go through a registration process. And so social workers would sit down with family heads or individuals and collect information on demographics and social information, who was what and what was happening, to make determinations about which camp they would go to, who would go together, who needed to go, who didn't need to go, what kind of aid that they needed. So, and if you've ever seen photos of people who were incarcerated, they always wear these tags, kind of like luggage tags. And those tags had family numbers on them. And so those were literally handed out by social workers. So tagging people and those numbers followed families throughout the entire process. And then, there were instances where social workers had to go and get people from their homes, people who didn't report, and put them on trains and send them off. Sometimes the trains and buses that went to the camps were accompanied by social workers if there were seriously ill people or young people and so on. So every part of the process of removal was administered by social workers.
I want to ask what's maybe a bit of a naive question, but did you find any evidence of social workers expressing any kind of misgivings or regret in being involved in this process that was, at least to my eyes, so baldly troubling and undemocratic and frankly racist? Did people express any kind of, I guess what I'm asking is, how willingly did people in the social work field go along with this?
Yeah, I looked hard to find dissenters. And I would say, for the most part, no. There's a lot of hedging. We don't think this is a good idea to, do this sort of blanket removal and blanket assumption of guilt. What we really should do is individual adjudication, which to me wasn't a very vociferous protest of this. I mean, there were instances of vociferous protest by other people. People saying things like, we don't think it's a good idea, but we are in a time of war, and we're going to leave it in the hands of the government because, of course, they know what they're doing, which is complete nonsense, of course. And the loudest protest came from the YWCA, which was actually at the time a really progressive organization, about as progressive as any organization was at the time. And they called this a racist endeavor, and you know, wrote about wrote protests saying, really, how can we actually fight a war on the fronts that we're fighting and do this racist thing at home? Yeah, nothing really to the scale that I was hoping for. Because, you know, it's not as if social work organizations and social workers did not know what the government was thinking. I mean, by the time the removal happened, the kinds of media, I mean, you know, Hearst Media in California, the kinds of really widespread racism about Japanese Americans and Asian Americans in general was something that was out in the world. And the government's, the federal government's rationale that the Japanese Americans were a danger and that they were going to be dangerous was well known. So when social work organizations such as the American Association of Social Workers were equivocating and saying things like, well, you know, we don't think it's a great idea, but we'll leave it to the government because they know better. They knew exactly what the government was thinking, right? So it was no mystery. And what's really interesting is that one of the rationale that the government gave is something that's been used in other settings as well. So it was that we need to do it. We need to remove the Japanese Americans for their own protection because the people around them, their neighbors were getting angry and we couldn't possibly protect them from all the anger that was arising from the war. But, you know, one thing I think it's important to remember is that at no time was the removal and incarceration of German or Italian Americans ever considered. And I think I mentioned in the book a really interesting testimony, discussion at the Tolan Committee hearings, which were congressional testimonies, hearings up and down the West Coast. And somebody said, well, what about, you know, what about the Germans and the Italians? And somebody said, well, I mean, if we were going to lock up the Italians, we'd have to lock up Joe DiMaggio's parents. And that would be downright un-American. And at this point, Japanese immigrants, the Issei, were barred from receiving citizenship, becoming naturalized citizens by the fact of their race. The 1790 Naturalization Act, which said that only free whites could become naturalized citizens, was a bar that held till 1952. So yes, they were aliens, but they were forced to be aliens. But the treatment was quite different. So you can't deny the racism behind this history.
And it sounds like many social workers, particularly white social workers, were primed to go along with this, in short, because of this long history of anti-Japanese racism in the United States.
Yeah, and I think if you look at social welfare history, social work, the history of social work with immigrant populations, the treatment of Asians was just really simply ignored. It wasn't a population that that social workers spent a whole lot of time thinking about. And, you know, the excuse that's always given is that, well, we didn't work with them because they were, you know, they had their own organizations, without really admitting that, you know, they had their own organizations because social work didn't work with them, right? They couldn't actually access mainstream services of any kind. So my own interpretation is that the no matter what social work thinks of itself, it's always part of the society, right? It's always part and shaped and deeply embedded in the discourses of that moment. So yes, social workers are just as racist, just as, you know, involved in the kinds of problematic thinking that anybody else was exhibiting at the time. And really, you know, the patriotic fervor, right? That you know, bounding into war and thinking about all that. So social workers were right there. And anti-Asian racism was part of social work. Yes, that is definitely true.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Once the United States government had removed people from their homes and people were living in these camps across the American West, not just the American West, but predominantly in the American West, how were social workers involved in camp life? What role did social workers and social work play in the day-to-day life of people living in these places?
I won't dwell on this, but just to mention that once they were removed from their homes, they first went to what are known as temporary assembly centers. So those tended to be in places like in Washington State, it was they were fairgrounds. And in lots of parts of California, they were like racetracks. So people were literally living in horse stalls and stalls that were meant for animals. And then from there, and that part was run by the military still. And then from there, they went on to these long-term relocation camps, which are usually known as internment camps, but again, a misnomer. So these relocation centers, as the WRA called them, created by the War Relocation Authority, a civilian agency that was created for the purpose. So at these camps, at every single one of these relocation camps, concentration camps was a word that was used at the time to describe these camps by the government officials themselves. There were welfare departments. So social workers were on site to provide aid, financial aid, and all kinds of counseling services. They organized funerals. They, so anything that was happening that might be happening in a social welfare agency out in the real world happened also in these concentration camps. So, and then afterwards, and, you know, one of the big jobs was to really then almost immediately try to get people to move out of these camps, out into the rest of the country. So resettlement processes were also heavily run by social workers as well.
And I was going to ask that question in a little while, but since you brought it up, can you talk a little bit more about how social workers were involved in this process of resettlement, especially as the war ended and the incarceration and relocation process ended and these concentration camps were closed? How were social workers involved in this resettlement?
You know, it's something that actually surprised me that I didn't know about was because, you know, logically it doesn't make sense, right? That resettlement, the push for resettlement happened almost immediately. So the camps started opening somewhere around the spring of 1942. And by the fall of 1942, the WRA had declared that an all-out relocation program, resettlement program was starting. And because, so what it, and then even prior to that, people were being released to farm work. Big agricultural concerns because they were short of farm workers. So people were being released on temporary basis to go and pick beets, for instance, let's say. in the Western, very Western states, and in areas that that they were too dangerous, considered too dangerous to live in. So what sort of doesn't make sense is that if they were so dangerous, why was the push to get them out so fast, right? And so that should tell you something about the whole process. So there were these leave clearance boards created within the camps to then individually determine who would be allowed out. So social workers were involved in that to start with. And then once this all-out resettlement, relocation push was established by the WRA, it meant that everything that social workers did was geared towards this. And the idea was to get them out and move them out to Midwestern states mostly and middle of the country and to the East Coast because they actually were barred from, the Japanese Americans were barred from going back to the West Coast. So how do we get them out and settled out in the communities? And one of the main goals was to really scatter the Japanese Americans. And this kind of scattering, that the idea that you wanted to scatter them thinly on the ground because to prevent the remaking of ethnic enclaves, and this problematization of ethnic enclaves as something that happened because immigrants, Japanese Americans were, and other immigrants too, actually European immigrants, were tended to be clannish and wanted to just hang out with themselves and refused to assimilate, was a narrative that was longstanding. And it was actually a policy that was used on indigenous Americans to try to assimilate them fast, right? So it's a longstanding narrative. And so how do we get them out and how do we get them thinly placed so that nobody will notice that they're there for one thing, and then nobody will protest. And then to put them in places where we will, they'll assimilate. And so even organizations like the YWCA, which tended to be really pro-Japanese Americans and much more progressive philosophically than others, were really behind this resettlement idea, at least at the beginning, because they thought this is the best thing that could happen. This was the best way to integrate Japanese Americans into American, meaning white American society. So social workers were part of every part, and it was a complicated process, which we could talk about some more.
How has the field, kind of taking a big picture, maybe from, you know, after this point kind of view, how has the field of social work reckoned with this history? Indeed, has it reckoned with this history at all, or is your book sort of a step toward that, perhaps?
Well, I guess, you know, as an author, I'm hoping that my book is a step towards that. But like I said, my book and my articles remain the only mention of this history, period. Yeah, and people are, I mean, my articles and my book are being used in schools of social work, in policy courses and history classes. So there's some degree of recognition that this is something that we do need to reckon with. But I think it would take a lot more than just my own work to do this. But, you know, so I don't think we've reckoned with it at all. And the reigning narrative really is to not be looking at this type of history. And so, you know, whenever I've given talks about this, whenever I've talked to anybody about this, I talk about the present day relevance of this, because there's really frightening echoes of what happened during the war and in these camps, and what's happening with what's happening on the US-Mexico border. With asylum seeking migrants coming in and immigrants that are coming in through the southern borders and getting incarcerated. So, you know, things like, do you remember maybe last year or the year before, there was, you know, big splash of news for a few days about how people in these detention centers, detention camps now weren't given things like toothpaste, right? That's exactly what happened in the concentration camps that the Japanese Americans were living in. They had to spend their own money for all kinds of, I mean, they were given basic subsistence, but anything else had to be paid for, which was a really quick way to impoverish everyone in those settings. So yeah, I don't think we've dealt with this history or the implications of this history, and I hope that we will.
And perhaps you just answered this question a bit, but as we begin to wrap up, I always like to have my guests sort of think big picture or top down about their book. And I'm curious what takeaways, or if there is one takeaway that you hope a reader will come away from your book understanding, what might that be?
I mean, I guess, you know, there are a few things that I've been talking about in any opportunity that I have, which is that, you know, this is some what I just said in part, which is that, you know, I went into history as a study thinking, you know, I needed to sort of catch myself up, right? I needed to go study history because I needed to figure out how we got here. And then the more I studied history, the more I realized that I was studying the present. And that in order to understand the present, you do need to know the history. You know, how did we get here is exactly going to really give you analytic chops on how to really understand what's happening now. So that's one takeaway that we really need to make in order to understand what we're doing, and especially what we're going to do and what we should do. I think in one that part of that the book, I said something about how, you know, if we are actually intent on doing social work in a way that at least attempts to avoid the past mistakes, then we need to know what those past mistakes were. So that's one part of it. And then I feel like in looking at this archival data, I came across this one statement by a social work supervisor from California. And he said something about how the use of social workers, trained social workers, you know, allowed this process to happen in a way that was, you know, doing a terrible job as decently as possible. And that really stuck with me because I feel like so much of social work history falls short of doing what was decent. And there's so many instances where we could have done so much more and we didn't. And more than that, I really feel like if social work wants to claim social justice chops, it really needs to think about expanding the definition of what is decent rather than sticking with a received narrative about what is decent. Does that make sense? So that we really need to think about how do we expand ideas about rights? How do we expand ideas about what social justice is? And how do we expand and really challenge and decenter ideas about racism and who is deserving, who is not deserving, who is us and who is not us? But that we haven't done so. And I hope that something like this history will remind people that that is what we say we do, but don't deliver on. And so that's my hope for the book, really.
I really like that concept of expanding what people mean when they talk about decency, right? And if we were talking before about how, you know, particularly white social workers were they were almost ready to engage in this nefarious work because they were part of this society that was in and of itself racist, then how can social work do something to transcend the society that it is in today to create a better society? Is that a fair estimation of what you're saying?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think, you know, that's not an easy task, but I think, I guess what I'm asking is, yes, how do we live up to our own rhetoric? And instead of working off of taxonomies and categories and philosophies and ideas about people that are received, that we know are problematic, how do we work to actually push the edges, right? And do something different, at least try to do so. So yeah, social work for social work to live up to its own rhetoric, then we need to challenge our own ideas about our own limitations about what decency means.
And then finally, Yusun, I always like getting a preview of what my guests are working on next. You've been working on this book for quite some time, and it finally came out last year. What have you been working on in the interim? Do you have any new projects coming down the pike that you'd like to give us a preview of here?
Yeah, so, you know, this book took me way too long because, you know, I thought I was going to do really an analysis of what went on. And then I realized as I was writing it that because there was no other information out there, I had to put a lot of information in to just establish what happened, right? So it ended up taking forever. So, you know, I swore that I wasn't going to do another book, at least for a while, but then I immediately jumped into another one. So what I'm working on and have been working on since last year is a new book on the involvement of social workers in the Americanization movement. So which happened, you know, sort of, let's say, two decades around on either side of the turn of the century, from 19th to the 20th. And I think mostly we think of the Americanization movement as a national movement that so many different institutions were involved in, including social workers to a great degree, on quickly assimilating new immigrants into the American norm. Ford Company had its own Americanization department, for instance. So industry, you know, religion, public education, social work, they were all involved in this. But social work, again, doesn't know much about its own involvement. So the book is about that. But then as I started researching this and started writing it, what I've realized is that because social work was involved, because it's really an era when so many immigrants are coming, and so much of what happened then has determined who America is, what is America, who is an American, was in many ways constructed in that period through the Americanization movement. So I'm ending up writing a book about what is America, which is a ridiculously large topic, right? So I keep finding myself in a pickle where I think I'm writing a much smaller tale and end up realizing that I have to study so much to know about so many things. But I think this will be a really, really useful book for social work, at least, you know, I think, because so much of it has to do with, it's not a past history, once again. How we currently formulate how we think about newcomers and how we think about the societal other, the roots are there. And just really the last thing I'll say is that, so I thought I was going to study social workers working with immigrants, and then realized that the roots of Americanization really goes back to settler colonialism. It's what we did with indigenous populations, and that whole notion of needing to civilize that population, and also with African Americans, the need supposedly to civilize freed slaves post Civil War, because all of a sudden they had the vote, right? Technically, theoretically had the vote. And that meant that there was a great deal of anxiety about how to make them into viable citizens. And whereas we could simply say, okay, we're going to block the Asians from coming, and the Mexicans and people like that we can deport when we don't need them anymore. Native Americans, Indigenous Americans, and African Americans were here. The country was sort of stuck with them, right? So then what do we do with them? So the reformist, the progressive impulse was to assimilate them. So that is part of the whole Americanization narrative. And all the things, the ideas that we built then are in play today, and in so many ways. So I think, again, I'm writing about the present, but through this lens of Americanization.
That sounds like an excellent project. And as you were saying at the outset, we need more histories of social work written by social workers. So I'm glad to hear that you are diving back into the past once again. Dr. Yusun Park is an associate professor of social policy and practice at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And her newest book is Facilitating Injustice: The Complicity of Social Workers in the Forced Removal and Incarceration of Japanese Americans, 1941 to 1946, which came out with Oxford University Press last year in 2020. Thank you so much for joining me today, Yusun.
Thank you for inviting me. It was fun to talk with you, Steve.